Welcome to yet another episode of Shortcast Over Coffee. Today, my guests are Chinmay Malavia and Charlie Deppman, the co-founders of the exciting startup RidePanda. RidePanda is a digital platform offering e-bikes, e-scooters, and e-mopeds as a way to promote eco-friendly transportation. In this episode, I talk to Chinmay and Charlie about their inspiration behind starting RidePanda, their shift from micro-mobility platform to leasing e-bikes at an enterprise scale, and their observations and learnings about the state of urban transportation in the US. Please do like, share, and subscribe this channel, Shortcast Over Coffee, on YouTube and all podcast platforms. So without further ado, let's dive right in. Hi, Charlie, and hi, Chinmay. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Bala. Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Bala.
Yeah. Awesome. Really exciting startup, RidePanda. And I have to say that I am a customer of RidePanda, even though I'm not a personal customer, but through like my company. I've had a fantastic experience, and I was always interested in this space of urban mobility, and partly due to my experience with this organization called Design for America. So I was a grad student with Design for America, and they had a project with Fiat Chrysler, where they had had a proposal to design transportation for rural communities, where it's a population of, let's say, 50,000 to 75,000. They don't have like a frequent bus system. So what is the best way to design urban mobility? And what we came up with was very similar to RidePanda. So that was really exciting to see that a company like RidePanda is getting a lot of funding, a lot of traction. So congratulations on how far you have come with this.
Yeah, thank you, Bala.
Awesome. So let's get started with the background. I know that you both were with the micro mobility space. So let's go back in time, and let's go back as to how you guys met and how this whole process started.
Great. You can do it. Go ahead, Charlie.
All right. I'd say I got into environmental work and micromobility thanks to my time in China. So I lived in China for about 2.5 years. And ultimately, my takeaways from living there were that I wanted to work on environmental issues for my career, and that light electric vehicles like electric mopeds, e-bikes, e-scooters were so well suited for urban environments. And that was in high contrast to the single occupancy SUVs I saw when I came back to the US every time, back to SFO or JFK. Back in 2014, I came back to the US more permanently and discovered this company called Scoot, and they were the first ones doing shared micromobility with a smartphone in San Francisco through electric mopeds. And it really struck a chord with me, so I ended up joining them as one of their first engineers. Our mission was really to get people out of cars and onto electric mopeds, but then eventually also onto electric scooters, electric bikes, and even a little tiny electric car. I worked at Scoot over the course of 4 years with a lot of different vehicle types, seeing how these different vehicle form factors served different purposes. So, for some people it was for deliveries, for some people it was for commuting, for some people it was just joyriding, and for some people it was like going across town to see friends. So there are all these different use cases that were better served by different vehicle form factors. So, the scooter versus the e-bike versus the moped versus the car. And saw that they all served these different purposes, and same with, people's different body types as well. Like some people don't fit on an electric moped very well, so an e-bike's a better fit for them, or maybe the scooter. And so at the end of my 4 years at Scoot, we were gobbled up by Bird. I like to say gobbled up. So acquired by Bird, and ended up working at Bird for about a year. Starting to draw some parallels with Chinmay's history that we'll move on to. But Chinmay was at Lime, we like to say the greener company, while I was at Bird. And I think we'd started to see similar things in the industry at our respective companies. So, you know, started seeing that, you know, there's a huge appetite among consumers for something more than the, you know, rent by the minute. So a short-term relationship. So we saw an appetite for longer-term relationships with these vehicles through ownership, through leasing, through subscription. So while I was at Bird, we were, you know, dipping our toes into ownership. So letting people buy the birds. And I couldn't tell you the number of times when I was at Scoot that people would come up to me on their own Vespa and I was on a Scoot and they'd be like, oh, hey man, I loved Scoot, but I bought my own. And so, you know, I've been seeing this at Scoot and at Bird, sort of this big appetite for closer connection to the vehicle. So like having it with you at home and having it always available to you, as opposed to having to go onto an app and trying to see if one's nearby, see if it has enough power for you to go to where you want to go. And also when you get there, like, is it even in good shape? So I think the power of having your vehicle at home with you, whether it's, you know, yours, whether you bought it or you have it on a subscription or a lease basis, is really powerful for the consumer in terms of just the reliability of it. So, you know, in 2020, I met this fine gentleman, Chinmay, and he'd come from Lime and had been seeing very much the same thing in the industry. And Chinmay had been, you know, working with a lot of different form factors as well at Lime, sort of seeing what form factors were next for them. I think our experiences really meshed well together. And we were looking at, you know, what's a better way forward for micromobility outside of the sort of rent by the minute scheme that could really help move the industry forward in terms of changing behavior, especially in America where we're so addicted to cars. It's like what will actually get people to change their behavior? And I think we saw a really nice opportunity at the beginning through retail to help people start owning these vehicles. And now we've moved into subscription, but we can get into that a little later. And I'll let Chinmay tell a bit about his story as well.
Yeah, thanks, Charlie. And I worked most recently at Lime, which was a fantastic experience for me to see how you build and scale a Silicon Valley company. I've had an entrepreneurial experience with back in Asia. So that was fun to see. My takeaway is very similar as Charlie mentioned. You know, on the macro level, Lime did 100 million trips, right, in a year and a half. That's like, you know, 100 million trips of that potentially did not happen on a car or any other vehicle, but in this new, fun, innovative electric form factor. And also, you know, I had a strong desire to do something more meaningful as my next venture. And Lime gave a lot of the data points there. If you look at just the climate crisis, transportation is number one cause of emissions in the US. Half comes from passenger cars. 60 to 70% car trips are in 0 to 5 miles. Combine it up with what kind of demand Lime was seeing, or even just during COVID, how many people were looking for single passenger safe as a get around. And the technological evolution around different types and kinds of e-bikes and scooters out there for different use cases, body types that Charlie mentioned, it just connected so well that there is something here, right? That I'm excited to lean in. And I think while sharing is great, and I wish Lime, you know, the best in terms of really getting people out of the cars and also vetting people's appetite, you know, choice was a challenge. We are a single form factor, convenience and reliability, as Charlie mentioned, a challenge. If you wake up, you may have a line, may not have a line. Affordability was a challenge. A single trip can be $10, $15, which very quickly becomes a few hundred in a month. Those are the ethos we took over to write Panda. We started now 4 years ago. And it's been a wonderful journey to get, like, not just avid bikers, an amazing e-bike, but also a lot of our, I would say 40% of our customers are actually new to biking or new to micromobility, which is just very meaningful to see and exciting to see that actually we are moving, you know, the needle forward in terms of getting people out of cars into these new, fun, sustainable vehicles.
That's fantastic. Charlie, what were you doing in China?
Yeah, so I did a combination of things. The first time I worked in China was with an environmental NGO called Future Generations. And yeah, we've helped lead a bunch of environmental movements across China. to raise environmental awareness. And then I also worked there with Waterkeeper Alliance, which is based in Manhattan here. It's an umbrella organization for many smaller NGOs that work on water issues and patrol bodies of water and help bring polluters to justice through legal action.
Hmm.
And then most recently, I was at NYU Shanghai teaching writing. But that's where I sort of started getting plugged into the startup community there, which is quite vibrant, and getting myself into software.
Hmm. Excellent. Wow. What an interesting background and quite the pivot. I noticed that the two of you were talking a lot about form factor, and I think that's really interesting to me because the way I see it is in two levels, on two levels. One is the form factor of, let's say, e-scooters, or like I would say the Lime scooters or the Bird scooters, and the second is something like city bikes, right? I mean, where you just go tap in your card and it's a little I don't know. You just feel a little safer on the road, if I may say that. The very first time I got one of those Ninebot, or I think it was Segway, I don't quite remember. I think it was 4 or 5 years ago. And one of the main problems with that form factor that I found was it was extremely bumpy, and like you could feel every bump on the road, and it was pretty hard on your shoulder. And the second thing is you just did not feel safe on the road at all. Like, I mean, you would go on a 45 miles per hour strode, and the wind of the cars would just scare you. And I don't think I have quite an experience with city bikes, but what is your take on this form factor? I mean, what is the kind of market that a Lime or a Bird is capturing versus what you are capturing?
So I think it's a good question, Bala. And I think for us, I think we've been in giving folks an opportunity to make that informed choice of what is the right fit for them. There was a time where we used to ship different types of electric scooters and bikes to people's homes. We have moved away from that. We have now primarily have hubs in each cities where Bala, you had the chance to experience that. So it's more like who you are, where do you live, how do you expect to use the vehicles, are you living on top of a hill, do you have storage in your apartment, what else do you want to do you want to commute, do you want to take kids to school, do you want to ride joyride, and a lot of these things we understand, and then based on that we'll suggest and recommend you the right vehicle. So electric scooters, for example, like maybe your roads are a little patchy, right, and you have solid tires in a scooter, and you know, maybe that's not the best fit for you, right? Maybe you need a little more fatter tires that can help you with the terrain that you're going through, similarly, it might be the case that you don't have a lot of storage. Maybe you need something that, you know, maybe you want to take something on a Caltrain or a BART because your office is 25 miles away, and then it's 2 miles to go back and forth. And maybe then you actually like an electric scooter form factor because it's portable, lightweight, you can take it on a train. Some folks want to get some exercise, right? So maybe they like a foldable pedal bike. Maybe they just ride a road bike. So I think our goal is less so on telling people, hey, this is one size fits all for you. I think our goal is to basically have the best quality vehicles available and make sure for the longevity of your use case, which is, you know, we would like to think forever that you keep using your vehicles. We are there to support you in terms of service, insurance, etc. So you have that long-term relationship. And I can tell you one more in an interesting snippet. We actually were only e-mobility, right? Our customers told us, hey, I just want a pedal bike. Get me a good one that I can use and ride. And we were like, oh, actually makes sense. Why not? So we added that form factor. People ask for a portable pedal bike. So we added a different form factor. So we are reacting to what the demands are, what fits the customer's needs, and then accordingly adding the right vehicle for them as part of our choice. We don't also want to overwhelm people. So we have a curation of around 10 vehicles, more or less. And that's how we would like to keep based on what folks want.
Mm. Yeah, one other interesting observation that I've made in the US versus, let's say, like a European country, like a Denmark or, I don't know, Netherlands. I think Netherlands people bike a hell of a lot, is that people do not bike in the US for commute. Like they don't do their groceries in a bike. Few people do it, but I don't see that culture even in cities. I mean, people maybe walk to their corner grocery store and get their stuff. But in a country like Denmark, people do bike as like a form of transportation, daily commute. It's not a mean for recreation. I mean, I think you see people keeping their bikes on their SUVs, going to a park and then biking there for like, I don't know, half an hour or whatever, right? So how do you see this difference in, let me just call it biking culture between Europe and the US? And do you see it changing?
Yeah, no, that's a great observation, Bala. And certainly spot on. And I think that's something that, you know, here that we at Ride Panda would love to move the needle on in the United States. As you've keenly observed, it's not really such a utility biking culture in the United States. It's more of a recreational one. So, you know, you see your people, you know, driving their pickup truck to the, you know, the mountain to go mountain biking, or everyone's in Lycra or spandex sort of, you know, getting their miles in over the weekend. And it's less of the case that, you know, I'm at home and I want to go to the grocery store. Oh, I'm going to choose my cargo bike. No, most people in the US are going to take their car. If they can walk, that's great, but that's not the case for most people. And yeah, I think that is changing. And I think there's in the US, it's changing, you know, a little more slowly than we've seen in Europe. And I think, you know, going back to some of your earlier points around, you know, infrastructure, there are differences in infrastructure in the US. And luckily, we've seen that changing, you know, over the past decade. And even during the pandemic, we saw some really nice advances, like in San Francisco, they closed Market Street to most cars. So now it's, you know, much easier for people to bike on Market Street in a safe manner. But yeah, I think that's something that we're trying to drive with our service as well, is like helping people see bicycles and even scooters as more of a utility here, and not just a toy or something for recreation, but really getting people to, you know, fall in love with these vehicles, and make it as easy as possible for them to reach for their bike as opposed to their car when they do need to go to the grocery store. And, you know, we've seen that. We've been surveying our riders. So not only are they using our bikes for commuting, they're also using them over the weekend and in the evenings for things like grocery shopping, for things like going to see friends, and then also for recreation. But I think at the very minimum, what we are providing that enables that is like this nice service of having a super high quality vehicle that, you know, you enjoy riding. So it's something you want to get in. It's like, oh, well, you know, you have this sports car, but you also have this beautiful e-bike that's really fun to ride, and you're getting some exercise. And, you know, if something happens to the bike, if, you know, there's some maintenance required, we take care of it. So we just, Ride Panda wants to make it so that it's as easy as possible to own these vehicles, have them at home, and make it just like a no-brainer to choose it over the car, because it's fun, because it's active, because you get to engage with your environment more as opposed to being in the box of a car. So yeah, I think you're completely right. Like Europe is ahead of us on this, but we are making, you know, steady advances forward to making these vehicles, you know, something that Americans can now choose for their, you know, activities that are more utilitarian.
Yeah. And the only thing I would add, Bala, is that the electric form, the electric piece is what is the exciting part. That's, you know, that has been the big technological revolution, as you very much are aware of, and living that lifestyle. That we hope, and we're already seeing some data points that are enabling the, you know, American customers to embrace that. You know, maybe not at par at Europe yet, but also at larger numbers. And the addition of throttle, right? Like the electric scooter form factor, Sometimes in legality in the US, you can have a higher motor, less so in the Europe, but that was fine to get people to, you know, embrace that lifestyle, right? And I think it's a function of course, infrastructure, that there are improvements being done. But at the same time, you know, e-bikes, people ride longer, people ride more often, right? So it's removing some of the barriers of hills, some of the barriers of distance by enabling that. For all your listeners, we would love to get them, you know, to get people out of the car mindset. For example, in the US, parking as a benefit is free tax, but biking is not, which just shows you how things are at and the stage we are at. But I think given the interest and excitement and also the climate crisis, we of course are, you know, feeling good that there's a better future in front of us, you know, with a lot of hurdles and challenges, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I want to tell my listeners, my personal experience is that, you know, if you want to get to any place within a 5 mile radius, which is, like you said, probably 60% of your trips, right? If you ride an e-bike, which goes at a max speed of, let's say, 20 to 25 miles per hour, depending on what category it is, there is absolutely no difference in you reaching the destination on an e-bike versus a car. And I have tried this, I have timed this, and I can say this convincingly because, you know, we sometimes discount the fact that we have to walk so much to the parking lot. We have to park the car, lock the car. You know, with an e-bike, you can literally go right next to the entrance of the grocery store. I mean, people just don't realize that. And, you know, the time that is spent on traffic lights, of course, bikes have to obey traffic rules. I'm not discounting that. But if there is a bike trail that, you know, probably has some bridges or whatever, right? I mean, you can pretty much get to any destination within 5 miles just as soon as you would in a car. So that has been my observation. And I think people don't realize this. And it takes far less time to get ready on a bike. You can literally bike from your doorstep to the doorstep of your grocery store. So I just wanted to make that point as well.
No, definitely. And many times it's even faster. I mean, I can't tell you the number of times I go on Google Maps and I'll look at, you know, there's the subway here, you can take a cab, or you can take your bike. Guess what? Guess what's the fastest? Almost 90% of the time is bike.
Yeah. And it's fun and healthier, and you are out there in the world versus stuck in a two-ton, you know, metal piece. So.
And just back on the, you know, form factor, grocery shopping, you know, behavior change, lifestyle. It's been really nice to see the popularity of cargo bikes in the United States. Like, I really think this form factor in particular is like an SUV replacement. It's kind of like the SUV form factor for e-bikes. It really does enable you to take your kids to school. It enables you to go grocery shopping and actually, you know, carry a bunch of groceries, not just the ones that are in your backpack. And it's been great to see that. And I think, you know, we've started offering a few different, you know, cargo bikes on our platform, and they've proved to be really popular as well. And I think just like many cars in the United States have turned into SUVs, I think that's sort of where the industry is going towards, is like these vehicles that really do provide a ton of utility outside of just getting you from A to B.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, cargo bikes are fine. I mean, they have bigger battery packs. They are heavier, it's like, I don't regret people moving from a normal e-bike to a cargo e-bike as much as I regret them moving to an SUV. Like, why do you need an SUV all-wheel drive off-roader for that one off-road trip that you're going to take once a year? I mean, why do you need a 7-seater to go get 2 bags of apples and 2 bunches of cilantro from the grocery store, right? I mean, 100%. It makes absolutely no sense. I mean, that's something that I tell people, but, you know, when someone is planning to get a car, they are like, it's not all-wheel drive. Like, what do you even need all-wheel drive for? Like, are you serious?
And I mean, what shocks me is, Bala, sometimes like 90% of the cars, this is New York stat, but I'm going to apply it in the US, are sitting at any time, right? 95% have a single, or 90-95% have a single person driving them. That is the stats. It's not like 50%, 90, probably close to 90%. So, you know, imagine all the space you can save and do so many things with that. So
yeah, absolutely. And I work in the Bay Area, so there are like 4 or 5 buildings right across the street from where my office is, where Google used to have its Tech Corner campus, and they vacated the campus. And the amount of asphalt that is lying there just like that, I mean, it's painful to see. I mean, I don't know if everyone feels the same way as I do, but it's just painful to see for me, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I hear you.
Anyway, great. So I want to move to, you know, we spoke about the form factor. We spoke about how e-bikes are useful in like a 5 mile radius and how more people should adopt for a lot of their daily needs. But when it comes to US in particular, I know it's true for a lot of European countries as well. US is not a tropical country. We have seasons. I mean, most of US has seasons, and the biking culture and the biking population changes with seasons. So what has been your observation, and how do you see tackling this scenario? I mean, with climate change, we are seeing more and more polar vortices and all of that, you know, year by year. Like, it snowed in Alabama, it snowed in Texas, Chicago went to sub-zero temperatures this year. So have you seen a radical shift in biking based off of what you noticed?
So I think like seasonality definitely for you know, non-covered vehicles like bikes and scooters, it is a challenge, right? And I think typically what we see is like the peak ridership from the summer times to winter goes to half, does not drop to zero, but still goes to half, given some people just don't, you know, will prefer to stay in and not do any trips or do less trips. I think this is what the bike industry has always advocated, I think, which makes sense as personally for me too, since I moved to New York. It's really about less about bad weather with bad clothing. How prepared are you to walk in the streets when it's snowing is similar to how prepared are you to bike, you know, when it's cold out. And of course, you know, things like rain, and you can add a fender, and, you know, some things you could, of course, do. But there are ways to mitigate some of those things.
I have a complaint about the fender, though. I mean, a lot of e-bikes that are manufactured in the US do not come with fender. And I owned an e-bike from a company in Netherlands, and it came with fender. So that's one something to think about for them.
No, definitely. And that's something, you know, we're some of our bikes don't come with fenders, and it's something we're, you know, considering adding on, so that people can use them more year round. I have a fun anecdote, but I lived in Montreal for 2 years, and, you know, the place is kind of covered in ice for like 3-4 months. It's intense. But they have, you know, dedicated snow plows that clear like bike lanes, which is amazing. And if they haven't, you know, I built an ice bike that has, you know, studded snow tires on the front, like little metal studs. And I know most people aren't, you know, down for that kind of thing. But I think my point around the infrastructure is that, like, these cities that do, you know, end up getting a lot of snow and ice, you know, some of them are doing a good job of specifically clearing, you know, bike lanes. And yet there are other, you know, cities and towns where what happens is the snowplow clears, you know, the way for the bikes, and all the snow goes right into the bike lane. So then it's like, it's, you know, no matter what we do and no matter what clothes we're wearing, it's not going to work that well. So, you know, the infrastructure piece is important. And some cities are honestly doing a really good job, you know, given the conditions.
I think I saw a video on, I think the name of the YouTube channel is Not Bikes or something, or City Nerd, one of those. I mean, where they were showing how clean the roads or the bike lanes in Netherlands and or Finland are, sub-zero temperatures again. And I've had this firsthand experience in a small town like Blacksburg, where I went to grad school in Virginia. You know, extremely small town, college town, lots of bike lanes. But come winter, and it's a mess. You know, like you said, all the snow falls on the bike lane, and it's extremely hard. Like, you're going 10, 15 miles per hour, and then there is a block, like, and then there is like a bus going right past you. So that was kind of difficult. that also brings me to the point, you know, how much is biking adoption related to policy? Because, you know, US, you know, we have the zoning laws, we have the whole history with redlining, you know, cities were way more close to each other with the, you know, after the war, I think, you know, it was all suburban culture, right? With a lot more, and the cities are designed for automobiles. I mean, the cities, the townships, the cul-de-sacs, I don't know why cul-de-sacs even exist. Like, I don't think they should exist. You know, this whole notion of building a safer community for your kids, etc., 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 it's been sold for over 50 years now. But how do you connect policy versus biking culture? Are you planning on doing something on that front as well? Like, I don't know, lobbying maybe?
Yeah, so I think it's a great question. I think, Bala, we talked about Europe quite a bit. So if you, and there's lots written about Amsterdam, for example, there was a 1970s oil crisis. If you look at photos of Amsterdam before that crisis, it looks like a classic American city from today.
Okay.
You know, and you know, heavy car traffic, and the oil crisis also kudos to the activism that a lot of big part of the community showed to step away and take a radical change and into what Amsterdam is today, which is one of the most bike friendly cities in the world. So I think that goes back to, you know, the right calls, the right policy and right infrastructure that were done, what now, close to 50 years ago. And fruits of that work, you could see that today in a city like Amsterdam. So we want similar things to happen in the US, right? I think there are, of course, barriers to adoption, biking. I would say electric does quite a bit in terms of removing any fatigue or hill concerns. Safety is a concern. You need protected bike lanes. Storage is a concern. Theft is a problem. Making sure that you could store in your vicinity, at your apartment building, at your office building, those are important. And, you know, financial help, right? I think e-bikes can still be $2,500 to $5,000, $6,000. Not necessarily very, very affordable, right? Much cheaper than a car if you do the math. But sometimes people look at bottom up and say, well, it's more than, you know, the next thing I'm looking to buy. So financial subsidies, like employers are increasingly doing around like the program that we offer, where it's like $50 to $50 a month, but the company is willing to spend $100, $150, $200 to help employees get that footing. I think it's very, very helpful. So I think that, you know, quite a lot of challenges. Some have to happen on the public level, infrastructure level, in terms of bike lane infrastructure, in terms of the right subsidies. And we are seeing that movement. I think it's the climate crisis is a push in for states like California. There are mandates by the government to reduce single occupancy cars. They're similar in Washington. In DC, if you give parking as a benefit to your employees, you have to do a clean air fringe benefit as well in parallel. So there are some mandates to either push the baton forward, but I think at the same time, while I can tell you the positivity, IRA, the Infrastructure Reduction Act that came out, you know, recently, missed bikes. Right. So now you're like, well, what's going on? So I think it's just that there is more interest and willingness, and it's seen as a solution. It's written quite a bit about how e-bikes can be a crucial part of the climate crisis. Being top of mind, being there, being advocating for it, you know, it's crucial. And I think we, of course, expect us to play a bigger and bigger role in the future. And we are talking to some government counties and states as well to be able to do some of that work. How do you allocate e-bike rebate dollars? What's the best way to do it? What is your goal here? You want long-term behavioral change. How do we really do that? What are barriers people may have, even if they get an e-bike today? What's stopping them to ride? Is it weather? Is it safety? Is it, you know, what is going on? I think we do quite a lot of there, as Charlie mentioned. Like, that is our desire, to get not people a bike, but get them to live and change that lifestyle. And lots to be done. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think from a policy perspective, you know, like a lot of changes that you mentioned are really welcome. But it's about city planning. I mean, whatever is done is done. Like, you just cannot bring cities closer because, you know, that's just how it is here in the US. But I think designing more walkable cities, for instance, or at least having this adoption drive in cities like Seattle, San Francisco will go a long, long way. Okay, so let me move to a very interesting topic, which is electric cars versus electric bikes. So a lot of the employers that you partner with also offer free charging at their location. So if I have an affordable, I mean, electric cars are not affordable right now, at least to the majority of consumers. But let's say electric cars become affordable. Let's say they become sub $25,000. Do you see a shift in the attitude of people where they would not go for an electric bike versus an electric car because of how convenient it is to charge and the whole comfort of a cubicle, you know, weather protected, climate controlled, you know, that's a big USP than, you know, wearing gloves and goggles and all of that. How do you see that?
I mean, like, cars don't solve our parking congestion problem. Cars don't make our cities more livable, given all the space they take, right? Cars don't de-stress us. They only add to our stress. Whereas e-bikes, you live that life, Bala, right? It's fun. It's healthier. You are out there in the neighborhood. You can make a picket stop, and it's easy.
Listen to podcasts.
Yeah, exactly. So you can do so many fun things. It's more flexible, more reliable. It's more affordable, right? You know, and even if an EV, you know, is made of more affordable, and I'm sure the prices will go down, it's still going to cost somebody $600, $800 a month. E-bikes can be a fraction of that cost and do all of these things, given the use case we have, especially in cities like you have 60, 70%, you know, or even like 80% of the trips that you're doing are in the zone of 0 to 5 miles that can be easily done with these vehicles. So there's a lot of other externalities and benefits, right, that the e-bikes can provide. Whereas maybe if I could paint the future, I would say, you know, like, maybe electric cars could be parked in the, you know, in the vicinities where people have to do longer trips. Maybe they are all shared. And the way people move in cities is with an e-bike or e-scooter or even walk, right? Like, that's, you know, that's also a great way to do that.
Yeah. Mm. And just to double click on parking, you know, from the perspective of our employers that we work with, you know, they want to avoid building new parking garages at all costs. And you know why? Parking is extremely expensive to build. So I think, you know, we've recently learned one parking spot in, you know, a tier one city in the United States, a single parking spot is $30,000. So imagine building a whole parking structure full of these things, enormously expensive, where instead you could have, you know, that same spot can accommodate, you know, a dozen bikes. So just, you know, it makes a lot of sense to avoid building more of these parking structures for cars. And, you know, also to touch on Chinmay's point around, you know, livable cities, cars do not make, you know, cities more livable, but bikes do.
Yeah. Yeah. I had Mayor Jim Brainard, the mayor of Carmel, Indiana, in my podcast. And what he did was he took away all the traffic lights in his city and made roundabouts. So which meant smoother flow of traffic, slower speeds, safer communities. And, you know, like you said, the cost of a parking lot is $30,000. The cost to purchase and install a traffic light is like $200,000. And the cost can go way up in like a Midwestern city where there are like, you know, heavy winds, snow and whatnot. And the maintenance cost can go up to like $10,000 to $20,000 per year. And a city, I don't know, I mean, has so many traffic lights. And I think making some intelligent decisions can drive down the cost, and just, it's free lunch pretty much. Like, it can, it's a win-win situation. It can make things better for everybody. So yeah, excellent point. And I think a lot of employers discount the fact that, you know, you need to provide charging for e-bikes as well at your, so they have these charge point, electric car charging stations offering free charging, but, you know, the bikes cannot charge for free, which is or you need to have a you know, removable battery, which I don't know. I think it's inconvenient personally, but yeah, that's something for the employers to think about, not for RidePanda. So
yeah, the beautiful thing about e-bike charging is that, you know, it works on a standard 120 volt outlet, and it costs about 7 cents to fully charge your battery. We're going to get, you know, 30, 40 miles of range. It's just incredibly cheap.
Yeah, absolutely. We spoke a lot about e-bikes, how you see e-bikes as a culture in the US. And now I would just want to double down on RidePanda. So from what I read, RidePanda first started as a direct-to-consumer company, and then you moved to more enterprise customers. What made you decide on that shift, and how do you see things now?
Yeah, I think it's you know, just like any startup would go, it's a journey. I think me and Charlie, as we met, we were united in our mission to get people out of cars, especially the 2-ton polluting cars, and get them on bikes and scooters for all reasons we talked about, that they're better for us, for the individual riding, but also for our planet. And we wanted to find a sustainable way to do so as a for-profit business. Initially, we were a marketplace, as you mentioned, where we were working with some of the quality manufacturers we can find, and then helping customers find the right vehicle for them, and then getting them the right support and service, which was a good business. I think it was a good start for us. And I think the challenges we faced were and the opportunity we saw with what we do now is what led us to change our model. The challenges were shipping vehicles. Folks, sometimes when you're online and you see this is the bike you want, maybe when you actually get it, it's the wrong size, the wrong type, you misread the specs, or you realize it's actually too big, or it doesn't fold as you want it to, it's heavier than you thought. All of those things, people were making all these mistakes, or it's not mistakes really, but like not having the right ability to be able to test them, write them, you know, led to those concerns. Now, we were working with some third-party service providers as well, but we realized quickly that, you know, once you have the right bike, then getting the right service was a challenge. And in certain cases, some we could guarantee well, some not so. And also, we realized some people, they were like, okay, I actually thought I wanted a bike, but no, a scooter is a better fit for them after 3 years down the line. And then, again, they were struggling what to do with it. So I think for us, it was like, okay, this makes sense. The demand is there. The experience we want to offer in terms of long-term behavioral change, we are not able to meet that in terms of the bar we have set for ourselves. And to really not, you know, get the next 100 people, but now next thousands on bikes, we had to really change our model. So then we changed to subscription, where we embed a lot of support, service, insurance, and the ability to swap and the ability to return a bike embedded in the program. We have built our own in-house, or what we call Panda Hubs. These are experience centers for folks to come in, try different vehicles, see what the right fit is for them, for their use case. And those are the centers that also act as their service piece and to help support that long-term relationship. I think that has been amazing to see. And also, we have also awesome to see that employers are coming in and, you know, supporting these programs for various reasons, to get people back to work, help them be more sustainable, reduce their scope 3 emissions, reduce, as Charlie mentioned, parking costs or shuttle costs and all of that. And that has been also, phenomenal to see that is able to not just get people who want a bike today, get a bike, but in almost half of our cases, get people who are maybe not thinking on an e-bike or scooter actually get a bike and live that lifestyle. So that's been quite an evolution for us in the past 4 years. And, you know, we'll continue to evolve and change and adapt as people need us and value us and help them. Kudos to the team here at RidePanda, not just us two, to be able to see the opportunity, react well, adapt, and, you know, and move away from inertia to embrace what makes more sense for us as a business.
Excellent. One of the other things that I really wanted to know was RidePanda being like a non-software startup. I know you guys are pretty heavy on software, but there are so many challenges with the business model like this. Like, there is inventory cost, right? You need real estate in major cities, and cities being walkable, like we mentioned, the real estate costs are extremely high. You need to store the bikes. You need experienced professionals for these services. So there is a lot of cost as compared to like a SaaS company, which everyone is going and starting these days. What have been some of the challenges, and walk me through that process, because we all know the win-win situation that you are bringing to the table, and also recognize the fact that employers are, it's also at an advantage to the employer to pretty much tie up with RightPanda. But just as a hard, I'm just going to call it a hardware business because it's not a software business. What have been some of the challenges that you had to overcome?
So I think it's a good question. And Bala, you know, there's of course real world, brick and mortar, four walls, mechanics, assembly, repair, service that happens. That said, I think, you know, technology is still forefront on how we're doing things. And maybe Charlie, you want to speak about the asset management and things we're doing. We're not running operations. We're running tech-enabled operations to make sure that we can really hammer through an amazing experience, right? You could do that on pen and paper at a certain scale, but to be efficient, to be reliable, to have a high-quality bar, to be able to manage the assets well, the thousands of bikes that we manage, to make sure that the costs around it, how is the turnaround times, the repair cycles, all of those things are done well. We need a good system to be able to enforce and ensure that. So of course we have, in terms of talent, we have dipped into the bike industry. We have some amazing folks who have joined the company who are believers in the mission, believers in biking, have been doing a lot of work in the biking space for quite a while. So we're able to, instead of reinventing the wheel, leverage their experience and expertise, but also building in-house bottom-up software, looking at employees and our operations at our customers.
Yeah, I'd say at the end of the day, as Chinmay mentioned, it's an efficiency game for us in terms of operations, because we are very dependent on these assets. So managing them is critical for us, and managing them in the same manner across all of our different hubs is also critical. So, you know, the software that we've been building enables that, you know, similar processes across all of our hubs. And I'd say, you know, we don't carry a lot of inventory, which is something that we're proud of. Like we're pretty light in that regard. So about 95% of our assets are in use at any given time. So we have some in our hubs that are for demos, so they sit around, and then some of our vehicles are in for repair. But we really want that super high utilization rate for all of our assets so that they can be making, you know, money at any given moment. So the sort of software platform that we're continuing to build really enables that. So that those really quick turnaround times, being able to track all those assets, see their value over their lifetime. As Chinmay also mentioned, like making sure people get that right vehicle at the beginning. And if they don't, you know, we'll be able to swap it for the vehicle that really fits their needs or their body type or their lifestyle, whatever that is. But we really want to connect the people to the right vehicle so that they can fall in love with it and incorporate it into their lifestyle.
Yeah. Okay, perfect. I mean, I think the kind of options that you guys offer is amazing. And I heavily encourage people to go check out rightpanda.com, look at the options. If you work for any of the employers that RightPanda is partnering with, definitely go through your employer. I think the product is fantastic. Okay, so before we end this podcast, I want you guys to address one of the more important things that I think a lot of city bike riders face here in the US is bike theft. I know you provide a fantastic lock with the bike as well, but I think the problem is, I don't know, I mean, at least in San Francisco, it's just crazy. How do you, do you get a lot of customer feedback? Do you get a lot of complaints about bike theft, and how do you address it?
Yeah, I mean, bike theft is this enormous problem around the world, honestly. In the US, it's pretty rampant, especially in our big cities. And you're right, Bala. Yeah, we you know, do our best on our side to provide riders with, you know, high quality locks from Kryptonite. And then we also do, you know, we train each rider on, you know, how to secure their bike properly, how to attach it to, you know, a real anchor point. And then if they have access, you know, storing it inside is really, you know, one of the best things you can do in a secure area. And fortunately, you know, a bunch of our partners, our employers do offer, you know, secure indoor parking. Now that's on, you know, the end of your commute, but the beginning of your commute or your home, you know, a bunch of people, especially in cities like New York, it's like you live in a walk-up apartment. It's hard to get your bike up. So for those folks, you know, we definitely encourage them to, at the very outset, just, you know, choose a vehicle that is easy to store. So that's maybe a folding pedal bike. We just added Bromptons to our lineup, which are, yeah, you know, sort of like the premier folding bike out there. Another option that's always great is an electric scooter. But yeah, it's like, okay, when I go to the grocery store and I do need to lock it up outside, you know, what do I do? So, you know, we are continuing to look at, you know, different security solutions. There are, you know, little alarms you can attach to your bike, which can be a great deterrent, and then other sort of lock mechanisms. I actually just had a meeting this morning with Shabazz Stewart, who runs this company called Uni in New York, and they're actually expanding all over the place, but they provide these beautiful storage pods specifically for bikes that are secure. So they have racks, you access the pod, use an app, and then there are locks inside that you can use. But this type of solution, I think, is incredible for dense urban environments where people don't have like a garage. And then even people who do have garages also suffer from, you know, break-ins and theft. So, you know, providing this type of infrastructure, whether it's provided by your company and they have like a dedicated parking spot, or provided by the city, like these Uni pods, where you can have one, you know, maybe on every street corner, is, I think it's a, you know, the kind of solution that we need right now. Unfortunately, it's just rampant. There's this whole sort of economy of stolen bikes out there.
And just to add to that, right, I think there's also bike indexes, so you can register your bikes. Mm-hmm. So if you're a customer and you're looking to buy a used bike, right, you can be, you know, there could be a little more discipline around making sure that this is the bike that I'm buying is the rightful owner versus maybe someone not. And at the same time, we also would love to work and welcome support from the law and order, right? Like in terms of helping, you know, mitigate that from the root, which is also a hard challenging thing.
Like, right? Yes, please, come on.
Right. So,
and to give our customers some peace of mind, you know, each of our customers, we also, you know, for every vehicle we have, we do have theft insurance. It does happen. It sucks. But when it does happen, we, you know, like to support you through that whole process.
Yeah. I would say law and order should be a little more strict, but I think here in the Bay Area, Caltrain, BTA in the South Bay, and BART have like this bike hub, like a metal cage where you can just park it for 5 cents an hour. It's not too bad. It's pretty safe. So yeah, heavily recommend that. Charlie, Chinmay, thank you a lot for your time. I think the product is great, and I really hope, I mean, I recently read an article that London has more bikes than cars. So I hope that happens to every US city, at least the major ones, you know, which are bikeable. So I hope that happens soon. Continue on your great mission and wish you all the best.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Bala. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah. Awesome.